The morning after my squadron of freshly acquired triremes sailed from Knossos, Waga and I set off in the darkness of pre-dawn to ride to Crimad, ahead of the ships. Following my instructions, Waga had saddled two of our horses, and we had four others on lead reins. We would be able to change horses as soon as the ones under us showed the first signs of fatigue. I had been warned by Toran that there were occasionally bands of robbers and outlaws skulking in the forests, which covered the mountains of the interior. With this in mind, I carried a short sword in its scabbard, hanging from my crossbelt, and my long, recurved bow slung over my right shoulder. As a slave, Waga was prohibited from carrying edged weapons, but he was armed with a slingshot and a leather bag of round river stones. I had watched him killing high-flying partridges with this weapon, and I had seen him drop a spotted deer that had been raiding our kitchen garden. I was sure that he could crack a bandit's skull just as efficiently. We started out before sunrise, as soon as it was light enough to descry the rough path. Waga was a skillful horseman, so he was able to keep pace with me. He knew every twist and turn and every fork in the track. He rode at my right heel, directed me with animal grunts and hand signals. To begin with, we cut obliquely across the lower slopes of Mount Ida, heading to pass to the east of the highest peak, which was still covered with snow even so late in the summer. At this altitude, the mature forest trees had been decimated to provide fuel for the forges and furnaces of the factories. The destruction saddened me. The axemen had left not a single tree standing. At last, we reached the virgin forests at higher altitude, and we rode in amongst the magnificent trunks of trees that had stood tall since the time when the gods were young. The upper branches entwined high over our heads, shading the aisles between them with a cool cathedral hush. The hoofbeats of our horses were muffled by the thick banks of green moss. The only sounds were the cries of the birds and small animals. We watered our horses at the streams that ran clear and clean as the mountain air and icy cold from the snow melt. We paused in a clearing in the forest, on the shoulder of the mountain, to watch Helios, the god of the sun, thrust his golden head above the eastern horizon. This was holy ground, where Cronos, the father of all the gods, had been born, and his sons and daughters after him. I could sense their presence and smell their perfume in the sweet air and the forest loams. It was an eerie sensation to be so closely in touch with the immortals. Perhaps my heightened sensitivity was due to the kindred blood coursing in my own veins, of which Inanna had first made me aware. Then I reminded myself sternly that Inanna was almost certainly only a creature of my dreams, and that I was the victim of my own idle superstition. It irked me that her image returned to me so persistently. I determined to put Inanna firmly out of my mind, and as I made the decision, I heard the echo of her indulgent laughter. Dream or goddess, I knew she was close, and my brave resolution crumbled. I turned my horse down the steep slope, towards the port of Crimad, nestled against the rocky southern shore of Crete. It was still 2 hours short of noon. We had made excellent time. Even at a distance of 20 leagues, I fancied I could make out the bare masts of my Sumerian ships huddling in the harbour. When I turned in the saddle and looked back over the way we had come, I saw the volcano in which the god Cronus was imprisoned. It dominated the watery northern horizon. A placid stream of creamy-coloured smoke trailed from its twin peaks. I smiled. The god was in an affable mood. Waga had taken advantage of this brief pause in our journey to dismount and squat behind the nearest tree. The mere fact that he had done so was an indication that before being taken in slavery, he must have been a person of breeding and manners. Only the lowest and commonest classes of men and women spray their water while standing. Suddenly, Waga leapt to his feet, letting the skirt of his chiton drop around his knees. As he pointed at the earth, close to where he had been squatting, uttering incoherent snorts and grunts. He was so perturbed that I dismounted and hurried to his side to investigate the cause of his concern. The soft earth at the base of the tree was so churned and broken that it took me a few moments to pick out the great cloven hoof prints impressed in the dirt. They were many times larger than those left by the milk cows on my own estate at Mekia on the banks of the Nile. I went down on my knees to measure one of these prints against the full span of my right hand, with my fingers and thumb spread to their utmost. My single hand was not large enough. I was forced to spread both my hands over one of the hoof prints to cover it completely. In the name of Seth, the malign, what monstrosity left these tracks? I blurted out my amazement at Wagga. I could make no sense at all of his response. He repeated the same sound in a rising inflection, while hugging himself and shivering in a parody of fear. Then he turned and ran back to his mount and scrambled up into the saddle. He gestured to me to mount up, and at the same time he darted fearful glances into the forest surrounding us. His agitation was infectious, and I jumped onto the back of my own horse and urged it forward. I was trying to find a rational explanation for these gigantic hoofprints. Their size seemed to be a fantasy rather than reality, until I remembered the massive skulls and horns of the aurochs that I had seen amongst the hunting trophies of King Nimrod in Babylon. However, the remote Zagros Mountains to the far northeast of the Euphrates River, where he had obtained them, were half a world away from this tiny, densely populated island. It seemed highly unlikely that there were wild aurochs still surviving in these lovely forests, unless they were protected by decree of the Supreme Minos. Perhaps he had declared these monstrous creatures royal game, as the heraldic symbol of the Minoan nation, and the creatures sacred to the god Cronus. The silver mask that the Minos wore gave some credence to that possibility. However, I doubted the wisdom of trying to discuss this with even Toran. He had already warned me not to pry too deeply into the affairs of the Minoan ruler. I glanced around at Wagga. He was still highly agitated. He was sweating, and his lower lip was quivering. He swiveled back and forth in the saddle, darting anxious glances into the undergrowth on either side of the path. He was beginning to annoy me. Even if there were wild aurochs still surviving in these mountains, his extravagant behaviour was unwarranted. Notwithstanding its large size, the aurochs was essentially a cow, and cows are placid animals. I was about to take Wagga sharply to task, when suddenly he screamed. Coming from his mangled throat and mouth, the sound was so unexpected that I was startled and distracted. His horse shied into mine so violently that if my reaction had not been instantaneous, I would have been thrown from the saddle. I recovered my seat and snarled at him. But he was gibbering with terror and pointing into the undergrowth above the path that we were following. "Calm yourself, idiot," I yelled at him. And then I broke off as I picked out the massive, dark shape looming in the thicket above us. At first glance, I had thought it was part of the rock formation of the mountain itself, but then it moved, and the image jumped into sharp focus. This was veritably a living animal. My horse stood 16 hands tall at the withers, but I found myself forced to lean back in the saddle and look up into the eyes of this creature. Those eyes were enormous. They fixed upon mine in a darkened, infernal stare. The creature's huge, bell-shaped ears were pricked forward, hearkening to Wagga's cries. Its back was humped, like that of a camel. Its horns were spread wide as the span of both my outstretched arms. They were thick and sharp-pointed as the tusks of an elephant that I had seen in Pharaoh's palace in Thebes. This was no placid, cud-chewing cow. I registered my amazement with a shout that matched Wagga's for volume. The creature lowered its head, presenting us with those murderously pointed horns, and at the same time it pawed the ground with its front hooves, throwing clods of soft forest loam over its back. Then it launched itself down the slope like an avalanche, crashing through the undergrowth, its eyes still fixed on me. I was trapped on the narrow pathway, with no escape route and no space in which to turn or maneuver. Nor did I have time to draw my sword or string my bow. Wago's steed panicked and tried to bolt for safety, and it carried its rider full into the path of the Auroch's charge. But even in the face of looming death, the little man managed an incredible act of courage. His woolen chlamys was rolled into a ball and strapped to the pommel of his saddle. He ripped it free and with a snap of his wrist spread it like a banner. Then he whipped it over the head of the bull. I will never know if it had been his intention, but the cloak hooked in the lowered horns and wrapped around the bull's head, blindfolding the beast completely. Even having lost sight of the horse and rider, the bull hooked instinctively at them with its massive rack of horn. I saw the point of one horn enter Wago's chest below his right armpit and transfix him completely. It emerged from the opposite side of his body, bursting out through his ribcage. The bull tossed its head and Wagger's body was hurled high in the air. Still blinded, the bull hooked again, and this time he struck the horse, knocking it to its knees. By now the bull was completely disorientated. It blundered around in the shrubbery, crashing into the tree trunks, trying to rid itself of the cloak, which was still wrapped around its head and horns. Wagger had won me a precious moment of respite, in which to kick my feet out of the carved wooden stirrups and drop from the saddle to the ground. My bow was already in my hand, and I restrung it in a single movement. The quiver was still tied to my saddle, but I always carried two loose arrows tucked into my belt for just such a situation as this. I knocked one of these and drew, holding for a moment against the immense strain of the recurved ash stock. The bull must have heard or scented me. It switched its great body around, facing towards me. It was still swinging its head from side to side, trying either to place me or throw off the chlamys that was still tangled around its horns. I waited until this movement opened his right shoulder and exposed the front of his chest. Then I released. It was such short range that the arrow generated immense speed and penetration. It disappeared completely into the bull's chest cavity, leaving only a small external wound from which a spurt of bright heart blood pumped. My second arrow struck a finger higher, but on the same line. The bull staggered back onto its hindquarters before wheeling away and crashing blindly into the undergrowth. I listened to it tearing down the steep slope of the mountain. Moments later it went down. I heard its carcass strike the ground with a weighty thump. Then I heard it thrashing about in the bushes, its back legs kicking out spasmodically. At the end, it let out a mournful death bellow that echoed off the cliffs. It took me only a moment to gather my wits and still my shaking hands. Then I went first to where Wagga was lying. At a glance I saw that he had been gutted like a fresh-caught tuna. Blood spurted from the gaping wound, but even as I knelt beside him, the flow shriveled away. His eyes were fixed wide open, but the pupils had turned up into his skull, and his mouth had fallen open. He was beyond any help that I could afford him. His horse was down beside him. The poor beast had been gored in the throat. Through the pierced windpipe, the air bubbled from its lungs. In addition, I could see that its right foreleg was broken. Jagged shards of the cannon bone protruded through the skin. I stood over it and drew my sword. I chopped down between its ears, into the brain, killing it instantly. The string of remounts was still anchored to the saddle of Wagger's dead horse. I led them to the nearest tree and hitched them to it. Then I went to find my own mount and string. They had not gone far, and I found them grazing in the nearest clearing in the forest. I led them back to where I had left the others and hitched them to the same tree. When all was secured, I slipped and slithered down the slope to where the aurochs lay. I circled the mighty carcass, marvelling once more at its size. Now I understood the terror that had overwhelmed Wagga. This was one of the most ferocious animals I had ever imagined. It had attacked us without the slightest provocation. I could also fully understand why King Nimrod boasted of 100 kills of this beast, and why the Minoans had chosen it as the heraldic symbol of their nation. I knelt deferentially beside the carcass, respectful of such a formidable opponent, and aware of how near to death it had taken me. I unwrapped Wagga's blood-stained chlamys from the horns, folded it, and tucked it under arm. Then I stood back and saluted the dead bull with a clenched fist before I turned away. It had been an adversary worthy of my arrows. I climbed back to where the corpse of brave Wagga lay, and I wiped the blood from his face and rolled him in his own chlamys. Then I slung him over my shoulder and climbed to the fork of one of the forest trees and wedged him into it, high enough above the ground to keep the carrion eaters off him until I could arrange for his proper burial. I sat beside him in the tree and said a short prayer, entrusting him to the care of his particular god, whoever that might be. Then I clambered down to earth again. As my feet touched the ground, it shuddered under me so violently that I almost lost my balance. I grabbed at the trunk of the tree to steady myself. The tree was being wildly agitated. Its branches were whipping and waving. As I looked up, leaves and twigs showered down into my face. I thought that Wagga's body might be dislodged by the disturbance, but I had wedged it firmly. Around me, the entire forest was being shaken violently. The mountain itself was dancing. There was a rumbling roar, and I looked around at the peak of Mount Ida, just as a great slab of the granite cliff broke away and came down, sliding and tumbling into the valley. The horses were panicking. They were rearing and shaking their heads as they fought their halters, trying to break free of their tethers. I staggered across to them over the quaking ground. I gentled them and spoke to them soothingly. I have a special way with horses, as I do with most birds and animals, and I managed to calm them and induce them to lie flat on the ground, preventing them from bolting or falling to injure themselves. Then I looked back into the north, over the harbour of Knossos, and across the open sea to the twin volcanic peaks of Mount Cronus. The god was furious. He was fighting to be free of the chains with which his son Zeus had bound him. His roars were deafening even at this distance. Smoke, steam, and fire billowed from the vents in his mountain dungeon, blotting out the northern horizon. I could see rocks as large as the buildings of the city that he was hurling into the sky. I felt tiny and helpless in the face of such cataclysmic rage. Even the face of Helios, the sun, was hidden from us. Dark despair fell over our world. The very earth trembled with fear. The sulphurous stink of it filled the air. I sat with my horses and buried my face in my folded arms. Even I was afraid. It was a pious and devout terror. There is no place of refuge on this earth wherein you can escape the rage of the gods. I had slain the monstrous horned creature that was the alter ego of the god. Surely the anger of Cronus was directed at me for such a sacrilegious offence. For an hour, and then another hour, the god raged on, and then, as the sun made its noon, it ceased, as abruptly as it had begun. The sulphurous clouds rolled away, the mountain stilled, and peace returned to the world. I roused my horses and mounted up, and I led the string of loose animals down the mountain, picking my way through the litter of fallen branches and the small landslides of rocks and loose earth that the god had shaken from the mountain. 3 days previously, I had sent a message to Zaras to expect my arrival. Long before I reached the port of Crimad, I saw both Zaras and Hui cantering up the path towards me. At a distance, they recognized me, and with cries of relief, they kicked their mounts into a gallop. When they reached me, they reined down their mounts and jumped to earth. They almost dragged me from my own saddle, and one after the other, they embraced me. I swear on my love for Horus and Hathor that when Zaras released me from his crushing bear hug, he actually struck a tear from his eye as he told me, "We thought for sure that we had got rid of you at last, but even Cronus himself could not do the job for us." Of course, my own eyes were dry. But I was thankful that there was nobody else present to witness such a mawkish display. "Has the squadron of Minoan warships arrived in Crimad yet?" I attempted to get back on sensible terms. No, my lord. Zaras managed to wipe the grin from his face. He pointed down at the watery horizon. As you can see, the sea has been whipped into a fury by the earthquake. Almost certainly they have been driven off course. I expect that they will be delayed for several days. How has our own flotilla ridden out the storm? While we rode on down the mountain, I made certain we discussed naval matters exclusively. I pretended not to notice the hand signals that we were sending Zaras, and his equally surreptitious refusals to comply with them. However, when we came in sight of Krimad Harbour, we could restrain himself no longer, and, writhing with embarrassment, he blurted out, "We were wondering if you had brought us any messages, my lord." "Messages?" I frowned. "From whom were you expecting a message?" "Maybe from the palace?" His voice trailed off. "You were expecting a message from the Supreme Minos?" I feigned ignorance. However, their beseeching gaze was pathetic, and against my better judgment I told them, "No messages. But you've probably heard that the princesses Tehuti and Bekatha are both married to the Minoan monarch, and are safely ensconced in the royal harem. You've both done your duty, and are to be highly commended. I will bring all this to the attention of Pharaoh at the very first opportunity. I know he will be grateful." With the next breath I went on, "I am sure you are wondering why I have arrived without an escort of any kind. There was an accident in which my servant was killed by a wild animal. At the first opportunity, I want you to send a burial party up the mountain to find his remains and give them decent burial." I kept talking and issuing orders, giving them no chance to pursue the subject of the princesses. I did not want to admit to them that I had no contact with the girls and had no idea how they were faring in the Seraglio. When we reached the port, I was astonished to find that even on this side of the island, which was protected from the volcanic upheavals of Mount Cronus, the sea had been churned into such a furious condition that the waves were breaking over the harbour wall and charging deck high through the anchorage. However, Zaras and Hui had taken every possible precaution to protect their ships. They had double-lashed them to the stone wharf, with the heaviest hawsers the harbour-master was able to provide, and hung them with thick fenders of plaited rope to prevent them from colliding with each other or with the walls of the wharf. They left only an anchor watch on board each vessel. The rest of us took shelter in an empty warehouse ashore as guests of the harbour-master. His name was Poemen, and he was a typical Minoan, melancholic and pessimistic. He invited me and my officers to dine with him that first night. I was surprised by this hospitable act. It was only later that I discovered he was not only harbour-master, but also a colonel in the Minoan secret police, and that he was drawing up a report on all of us Egyptians for the benefit of his superiors in Knossos. The food with which his kitchen provided us was over-salted and overcooked. The wine was thin and sour. The conversation was mundane and pedestrian, centering on the earthquake and the stormy seas that it had engendered. I was sorely in need of diversion, so I demanded of the company at large, "What is the cause of these earthquakes and volcanic eruptions?" Nobody was in any doubt that they were inflicted on humanity as a punishment for a crime or an offence committed against the gods. What crime would be serious enough to call for such an onerous punishment? I asked naively, and was hard put to maintain a sober expression as I listened to the diversity and the absurdity of their replies, which covered the full catalogue of human frailty and divine arrogance. After a while, even this palled, so I demanded, "In what manner can we atone to the gods for our trespasses?" They all turned their heads towards the harbour-master, the senior representative of the Supreme Minos present. He adopted a learned expression and a pontifical tone. "It is not for us to divine the will of the gods. Only the Supreme Minos, may his name be blessed through all eternity, is capable of such wisdom. However, we can rejoice in the secure knowledge that His Supreme Highness has already fathomed the cause of the divine anger and will make full recompense. He cocked his head to listen to the sound of the storm beyond the walls of the warehouse. Hark! The storm is abating. The anger of the gods has already been appeased. By this time tomorrow, the seas will be quietened and the mountains stilled. How does the Supreme Minos placate the gods so readily? I pursued the subject relentlessly. In the only manner that any god can be appeased, he replied, with a shrug and a superior expression. By sacrifice, of course. If it had not been for Toran's warning, I might have trespassed onto the dangerous ground of the nature of the Supreme Minos, but I curbed my tongue. The harbour master turned away from me and fell into a lively discussion with his assistants as to what extent the rough seas would affect the fishing. I was left with the uncomfortable and lingering knowledge that my killing of the Aurochs bull and the divine rage of Kronos had followed too closely upon each other to be mere coincidence. What sacrifice of appeasement had Kronos demanded of the Supreme Minos, I wondered. By dawn the following morning the waves were no longer breaking over the protecting walls of Krimad Harbour, and Zaras and Hui were able to continue their preparations for our naval campaign against the Hyksos. 4 days later, the 6 triremes that had been assigned to me by Vice-Admiral Herakal arrived in Krimad. They had been carried far to the east by the heavy seas, almost as far as the island of Cyprus. They were down to their last few barrels of fresh water, and their oarsmen were almost totally exhausted. I rested the Cretan crews for 3 full days and made certain they were well provided with food, olive oil, and wine of reasonable quality. They responded well. When the rest period ended, I began joint exercises with the 2 flotillas. Language was the main problem we encountered, but I saw to it that every ship had at least 2 interpreters on board and that the signal flags meant the same thing to the Minoans as they did to our Egyptians. Both flotillas comprised well-trained and practiced mariners, and within the week they were carrying out complicated manoeuvres, sailing in formation and forming line of battle. The Minoans soon learned to land chariots and infantry through the surf, and to recover men, horses, and vehicles again after they had carried out their assault. As they became more adept, so the mutual trust and camaraderie between Egyptians and Cretans blossomed. I was welding them into a formidable little fighting force. I knew that very soon I could unleash them upon the Hyksos. Of course, my main concern was to decide where they could do the most damage. Good intelligence wins battles long before the first arrow is shot, or the first sword is drawn from its scabbard. Then, without warning, a small and almost derelict trading dhow arrived off the entrance to Krimad Harbour. Its sail was tattered and stained. Its hull was zebra-striped with excrement, which its crew had defecated over the side. Its scruffy crew of 8 were bailing frantically to keep it afloat. They seemed more like pariahs than seamen. Their ship was flying no colours and lying low in the water, almost on the point of floundering. No pirate worth his salt was likely to give it a second look, which was probably why it had survived the voyage from wherever it had come. On the other hand, I am not as naive and arrogant as your average corsair. It was in just too much of an appalling condition to be innocent. I could smell the old fox's scent carried before it on the wind. I ordered Zaras to launch 5 of our longboats, filled with men and bristling with weapons, and to board her immediately. As soon as our attack boats cleared the harbour entrance, the strange dhow dropped her sail and hoisted Egyptian colours. Zaras towed it into the harbour and tied it to the wharf to delay it from sinking. The putative captain was frog-marched ashore, demanding to speak to Lord Taita. I made my appearance, scowling theatrically, and ordered him to be given 20 lashes to impress upon him who it was that made the demands in this camp. The wretch fell on his knees, pressing his forehead to the stones of the jetty. and made a recognition sign with his left finger. Arton and I had first used that sign all those years ago, when both of us were still slaves. I countermanded my flogging order, and instead had him dragged unceremoniously to my cabin on board my flagship, the Outrage. As soon as we reached it, I dismissed the guards and ordered my servants to bring hot water for the prisoner to wash in, and a fresh chiton to replace his stinky rags. "What is your name, friend?" I asked him, as my cook laid out a meal of shellfish and tuna steaks for us, and I prized the wooden stopper out of an amphora of Etruscan wine. "Friend is as good a name as any other," he grinned. "Better by far than the one my mother chose for me." "How is our mutual acquaintance?" I asked instead. "Large," he replied. "He sends you greetings and gifts." He went to the pile of his discarded rags and rummaged in them until he found a scroll of papyrus, which was stitched into the hem of one of them. He brought it to me. While I unrolled it, I indicated the food. He went to the table and fell to with a will. I glanced at the papyrus and saw at once that it was the present order of battle of the Hyksos fleet. In addition, Arton had noted those targets in the Nile Delta which he considered most worthy of my consideration. Whence Arton had conjured up such a document, I could not even hazard a guess. I re-rolled it. It deserved my careful attention, even though it was probably weeks out of date. "You spoke of bringing gifts, friend. I brought you 48 messenger pigeons. They are in cages in my ship." He looked pleased with himself. I unrolled Arton's letter and studied it once more. "The large man writes of sending me 100 pigeons," I spoke mildly. "What happened to the other 52 birds?" "We ran out of food." "You ate my birds?" I was appalled by his gall. He shrugged and grinned unabashed. I shouted for Zaras. When he came, I told him, "Go at once to this rogue ship. You will find 48 pigeons on board. Bring them to me at once before they disappear mysteriously." Zaras asked no questions, but hurried away to carry out my orders. My visitor poured himself another flagon of my precious wine and saluted me with, "Good wine. I commend your taste. Our large friend requests that you send him a commensurate gift to enable the two of you to communicate more regularly." I considered the suggestion for only a moment. I knew that Ambassador Torren had a large pigeon coop in Knossos. "How do you propose I send my birds to him without them also being devoured by jackals and hyenas?" He never so much as blinked at my calculated insult. "I shall convey them to him in person. That is, if one of your fine ships can take me across and set me ashore in an uninhabited part of the Nile Delta." "I can do better than that, friend," I told him, and he cocked his head inquiringly. "There is presently a Carthaginian trading dhow here in Crimad Harbour. The captain dined with me yesterday evening. 4 days from now, he plans to return to Carthage via the Hyksos port of Rosetta in the Delta. As you are aware, the Sultan of Carthage and King Gorab of the Hyksos are on neutral terms. I can arrange for you to sail with him as far as Rosetta. You will take with you 100 pigeons that have been hatched in Knossos and which will be eager to return to the coop as soon as they are released. That way the large man and I can be in direct contact within a very short time." "I know he will be delighted by that arrangement. The two of you may even use the opportunity to play a few games of Bayo by pigeon post." I found friend's attempt at humour to be insubordinate, and his intimate knowledge of my personal affairs disconcerting. I am never fully at ease in the company of these clandestine agents. They are a devious and mendacious lot. How can you trust a man who will eat your pigeons? While I waited for Torren to send my pigeons to me from Knossos, I had the derelict dhow in which friend had crossed the sea from Egypt taken out into deep water and scuttled, before she provoked the curiosity of one of the Hyksos agents that I knew must abound here on Crete. His 7 crew members I sent to the rowing benches of the outrage. 4 days later, when the Carthaginian trader sailed for Rosetta in the Delta, Friend was on board with 100 healthy and well-fed pigeons from Toran's coop. Before the Carthaginian disappeared over the southern horizon, I released one of Aton's pigeons to wend its way back to him, carrying my message, thanking him for his gift, informing him of the return gift that Friend was conveying to Rosetta on my behalf. I ended with a notation of my first move of the Baostones, the release of my heron from the West Castle. This was a ploy that always made Aton uneasy. The fact that I had taken umbrage at Friend's levity did not mean that I should reject his very sensible suggestion that I take this rare opportunity of continuing my Baal contest with Aton. The rising sun was on the eastern horizon as I took my leave of Zaras and Hui the next morning and rode back up the slopes of Mount Ida, heading for Knossos along the chain of relay posts that Hui had set up at my orders. He had done a fine job. His men had marked out the track with bronze distance tags nailed to the trees along the way. So I was never in any doubt of my position, and I never fell below a canter. As I drew nigh to each relay station, I blew a blast on my horn to warn the grooms of my approach. As I rode up, they had my next horse saddled and waiting. I paused, only to gulp down a few mouthfuls of watered wine. Then I was up and away again, munching on the meat and onion sausage that had been thrust into my hand by one of the grooms. I drew rein beside the fresh mound of earth which marked the grave of the slave who had given his life for mine. "Sleep well, good Waga. I know we will meet anon. Then I shall fully express my gratitude to you." I gave him the clenched fist salute. Then I kicked my heels into the gelding under me and started down the back end of the mountain towards the harbour of Knossos. As I rode into the stable yard behind my ambassadorial mansion, I glanced up at the afternoon sun and estimated the angle of change since leaving Crimad. "Under 6 hours to cross the island," I told myself with satisfaction. Despite the tiring journey, I went directly to the writing table in my library to attend to the pile of papyrus scrolls that were waiting my attention. Most of these were from Ambassador Toran. I sent one of my slaves down into the city to take my replies to Toran's house near the palace before I ate my dinner alone, and then went to my bedchamber. That night, I dreamed of Inanna again. She was standing on the terrace outside my chamber, and her hood and mantle were aglow in the moonlight. But I could not see her face under the hood. I tried to rise from my couch to go to her, but my limbs were leaden and would not respond to my dictates. I tried to speak to her, but my voice faded away before it reached the tip of my tongue. However, I experienced no urgency or concern at my own inability to communicate with her. Rather, I felt her benevolence flowing over me, and her divine power covering me like a shield. Trustingly, I allowed myself to lapse back into sleep. I woke again before dawn, and I sprang from my couch, feeling wondrously refreshed and alive. I was not prepared for this sense of well-being until suddenly I remembered my dream. Then my joy was tempered with a sweet regret that it had not been reality. I walked naked from my chamber through the door to the terrace, and I filled my lungs with the air that had been cleansed by the passage of 1,000 leagues of ocean. I looked across at Mount Kronos, and the god was in relaxed mood once more. I smiled when he belched a puff of darker smoke. Perhaps he had seen me on the terrace and was wishing me a good day, or he had eaten something for dinner that had given him a touch of flatulence. It was an indication of my good humour that I could indulge myself in such childish nonsense. However, It was an extravagant Psychodilla Ford. My plan was to launch our first foray on the Hyksos positions along the northern shore of the Delta within the next 10 days, and every hour must be made to count. I turned determinedly back towards the door to my chamber, and as I did so, my foot struck something soft. I glanced down to see what it was. Then I stooped and gathered it up and examined it, at first with mild interest, and then with mounting wonderment. It was a flower, or rather, a lily. But I had never seen the like, and I am an avid horticulturalist. It was the size of a large wine flagon. Its petals were the colour of freshly cast gold, shading down to glowing vermilion in the throat. The stamens were white as carved ivory, and the tips were blue as sapphires. It was magnificent, and so freshly cut that the stem was still bleeding drops of limpid juice. Gently, I rolled it between my fingers, and I caught the soft perfume. It was a scent I knew so well that I felt the hair rise on the back of my neck. It was the smell of the goddess Inanna, the perfume of Ishtar, the goddess of flowers, whose symbol was the lily. "It was not a dream," I whispered. "She was here." I raised the lily to my lips and kissed it. I felt it withering in my hands, the petals crisping and curling, the blazing colours faded to dull and ancient brown, like the sunspots on the hands of a very old man. Then the petals crumbled to a fine dust that trickled from between my fingers and floated to the tiles of the terrace. The light dawn breeze scattered them. The essence of the goddess seemed to have been absorbed from the lily into my own body, bolstering and fortifying me against I knew not what. I bathed in the leather buckets of hot water that the slaves had brought up to the terrace for me. Then I dressed in a blue wool chiton and went through to my library. The door was closed, although I had left it open when I came through to my chamber the previous night. I pushed it open quietly and then froze with religious dread when I saw the cloaked and hooded feminine figure standing at the window across the room with her back towards me. "Inanna," I whispered, and she turned swiftly and came to kneel at my feet and kiss my hand before I could regain my voice. "Lord Taita, it is so very good to see you. I missed you. All of us have missed you." She pushed the hood back onto her shoulders. "Loxias," I exclaimed. "I thought you were somebody else. How did you find me?"
"I asked my good friend Lord Torren. He told me where you were."
I lifted her back onto her feet and led her to the couch. When she was seated, I rang the brass bell on my writing table, and three of my slaves ran up the staircase from the kitchens. "Bring food and drink," I ordered. We sat facing each other while we devoured the large platter of boiled eggs, dried fish, pork sausages, and hard bread the slaves laid between us. "Is it safe for you to be here with me? I thought that you were imprisoned in the royal seraglio with Tehuti and Bekatha."
"Oh, no."
She shook her curls at me. "The viragos see in me only a low-born slave. They allow me to come and go as I wish." "The life of a slave obviously suits you very well, Loxias, and you are even prettier than when last I saw you."
"You are a naughty old flatterer, Taita," she preened shyly.
"Tell me about my other girls. Are they as happy as you are?"
"They both profess to be dying of boredom. They long for just one of your stories to amuse them."
"Doesn't their new husband entertain them?" I asked tactfully.
"You mean old Tinhead, the supreme Minos?"
She purred with laughter.
"That's what we call him. But I suppose he would chop off our heads if he heard us. Neither Tehuti nor Bekatha have seen him since the marriage ceremony. None of our new friends in the harem have seen him since their weddings. and some of them have been there for 20 years and more. Certainly nobody has ever seen him without his tin head."
"I don't understand," I protested.
"None of his wives have had carnal knowledge of the king. Is that what you're telling me?" Loxias had been friends with Ambassador Toran long enough to understand the meaning of the term, and she blushed modestly and dropped her eyes. "From time to time the Minos sends for certain of his wives to be brought to him by the viragos. However, once they leave the Seraglio, they never return."
"What happens to them?" I was puzzled.
"The viragos say that they are elevated to the rank of favourites of the gods, and that they ascend to the higher temple in the mountains."
I questioned Loxias minutely, but it was soon apparent that she knew very little about the subject other than what she had just told me, and that she was not particularly interested in the location of this higher temple. She attempted to change the subject of our discussion to the whereabouts and the well-being of Zaras and Hui. I knew that she was seeking this information at the behest of her royal mistresses. Repeatedly, I had to bring her back to our discussion of the multitudinous brides of the Supreme Minos. "How many of the other brides have become favourites of the gods since you and the princesses took up residence in the Seraglio?" I insisted.
40, she replied without hesitation. I was surprised by the number and by Loxia's certainty of the exact figure.
"So that is approximately one bride a day since you and the princesses have been resident in the Seraglio."
"No, no, my lord.
40 of them left the Seraglio at the same time. They went dancing and singing with flowers in their hair." "The Supreme Minos must have had a busy night," I could not resist the quip. Loxias struggled to keep a modest expression, but there was a sparkle of laughter in her eyes. I went on with my questions. "None of those 40 women have returned to the Seraglio. Are you sure of that?"
"I am completely sure of that. We know everything that happens in our section of the palace."
I pondered her replies. I had the uneasy feeling that I was missing something of deep significance. 40 brides all left together, and none of them have returned," I mused aloud.
"I have already told you that, Taita." Her expression was long-suffering. "Tehuti wants to know where Zaras is now."
"Is he in Krimad, or is he on patrol with his ships? She would like to send him a present. Would you take it to him?" I ignored the question. I was determined not to let myself be sucked into this intrigue. "When did the brides leave the Seraglio?" I laboured my point.
"They left at noon on the day of the earthquake," Loxias snapped at me impatiently. "Didn't I already tell you that?"
I stared at her as my mind raced to keep up with the twists and turns in our conversation. "Are you telling me that Tinhead had his wicked way with 40 virgins in the middle of an earthquake?" I demanded.
"I suppose so," she giggled. "If so, I would have loved to watch." She stood up. "I must go now, or the viragos will not let me back into the palace. Shall I take the girls a message from you?"
"Tell them I love them more than anything else in the world."
"What about me?"
she pouted dramatically. "Don't be greedy. You already have one old man who loves you, Loxias."
"He isn't so old," she protested. "He is quite young and very rich. He is going to marry me. Just you wait and see."
After she had gone, I sat alone on the terrace, thinking over everything she had told me. I could make very little sense of it, and I was left with a feeling of pervading unease, a sense of impending disaster. I wanted to hurry back to Krimad to immerse myself in the warlike preparations with Zaras and Hui, which I knew would distract me. However, I had to be at Ambassador Toran's pigeon coop when one of the birds that Friend had taken to Aton in Thebes returned.